From Washington, D.C., I'm Suzette Corlett, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. Tom Shanker spent nearly 14 years covering the Pentagon for the New York Times and says U.S. foreign policy should be about earning respect and trust instead of winning hearts and minds.
When Americans speak about Islam to the Muslim world, it sounds patronizing and insulting. The people who have to carry that message of tolerance and moderation are Muslims themselves who live there.
But first, Rebecca Cruz and I discuss the North Korean Workers' Party's first Congress in nearly four decades, and new details about American missionary Kenneth Bay's time in a North Korean prison camp.
Most people are glomming onto is his acknowledgement of Dennis Rodman's role in his release, that really drew attention to his plight.
These conversations are coming up right after this hour's news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Corlett. Rebecca Cruz, interesting news out of North Korea this week. Two stories, actually. So Kenneth Bay, the former prisoner, North Korean prisoner, but an American missionary that was held in North Korea for 2 years, was released back in 2014, but this week released his book about the experience entitled Not Forgotten. Very interesting details that came out about his time in North Korea. It enlightened us a little bit about that experience and what it is like for foreigners, particularly Americans who've been imprisoned over there, of which there have been about 10 or so over the past several years. So what is it that we're learning about North Korea from Kenneth Bay's book?
Well, this is really interesting because he says that when he was first taken, he realized that he might need to or might want to keep a record of this. So some of it comes out of his own journaling, things that he was able to write during the time, which is kind of not what we would think about when someone is in prison. But he commented that he was treated, for the most part, okay. He says it wasn't a grand hotel or anything, but thankfully he wasn't treated as bad as some others, though there certainly were times when he was interrogated and those sorts of things. I think what most people are glomming onto is his acknowledgement of Dennis Rodman's role in his release. The hubbub that all of that created a couple of years ago, he felt that really drew attention to his plight and that helped lead to his release. And, you know, he
but
was
interestingly,
told,
though, in the opposite way, it was like Dennis Rodman said something negative about Kenneth Bay and it drew attention to it wasn't as though Dennis Rodman was demanding his release because he's friends with Kim Jong-un, but he was actually critical of Kenneth Bay and that this somehow led to his release, yes?
Yeah, just getting it in the psyche, I guess, or getting it out there, the name out there, and bringing attention back to this prisoner that was in jail there. So yeah, he's not saying that Dennis Rodman, is responsible in the sense that he protested and called for his release, but that in speaking about him, it drew attention to it. And of course, there are still two prisoners that are over there. The most recent one just this past week was indicted and charged and apparently will face 15 years of hard labor. So this is his story has had a somewhat happy ending, but there still are two that are being held over there.
Well, another big story out of North Korea, and this is actually a huge story that they're getting ready to have, or they're having today, I guess they're launching today, the 7th Congress of the Workers' Party, which is the highest political gathering held in the country ever. When they have their Congress of Workers' Party, but this is the highest gathering since 1980. It's been 36 years since Kim Il-sung actually called for the Workers' Party Congress and announced at that gathering that Kim Jong-il, his son, would take over for him. So what is Kim Jong-un trying to get at here? There are lots of preparations, lots of rehearsals, lots of activity. So what are we expecting to hear from this really massive gathering?
Well, we're expecting to see some really impressive sights, a lot of really impressive pictures. If you consider that at the 6th Party Congress in 1980, as you mentioned, they had over 1 million people mobilized for a parade. They're hoping to do those sorts of activities and more. The citizens there have been gathering for weeks and months, not sleeping hardly at all to prepare for this, cleaning up, doing gymnastics rituals, all those sorts of things. So we're going to see a lot of really impressive visuals. And then we're waiting to hear and see what he has to say. Kim Jong-un is using this as an opportunity to further solidify his role there, his power. And this is the opportunity to go ahead and talk about policy. We are expecting the United States to be mentioned at least a couple of times, and we'll see what's going to happen there.
And nuclear weapons probably will play prominently here. Well, in the last minute we have, Rebecca, we have to go to back to history in our own hemisphere, and that is the first cruise ship to dock in Cuba in 40 years. This, you know, is quite interesting. Cubans rolled out to see the American ship pull up into the port in Havana. Is this another step in our changed relations with Cuba?
Absolutely. And it highlights the necessity for income. Cuba is looking to really heighten their tourist industry here. And it looks like American tourists are going to play a large role in doing that. The trip almost didn't happen because there were some Cuban-born citizens on the cruise. And there was an old Cuban law that said that they couldn't return in this sort of fashion. The Cuban government decided to abandon that law. And so the trip did happen and was a real emotional moment for some people.
Lots of diplomatic negotiations going on just to get this cruise ship into Cuba. Very interesting what's happening in the U.S.-Cuban relationship these days.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Rebecca, as always, for being here. And I'll see you soon.
Thank you.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this discussion or answer any questions you might have. You can leave your comments online at kgou.org or write to us on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU. I tweet at Suzak Rolat. All of our individual segments and past episodes are on our website, kgou.org. After a short break, I'll talk with Tom Shanker. He's the assistant Washington editor at the New York Times, but before taking that position, he served for 14 years as the newspaper's Pentagon correspondent. I'm Suzak Rolat, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzak Rolat. My guest today is Tom Shanker. He took a job as the Pentagon correspondent for the New York Times in May 2001. 4 months later, hijackers crashed American Airlines Flight 77 into the western wall of the building during the September 11 terrorist attacks, and he spent the next 14 years covering the war on terror. He spent time embedded with U.S. Army Special Forces in Afghanistan, and he co-authored the book Counterstrike, The Untold Story of America's Secret Campaign Against Al-Qaeda. He's also an Oklahoma City native and started his career at The Oklahoman. Tom Shanker, welcome to Worldviews.
It's a great honor to be here, Suzette. Thank you very much.
So, Tom, you've written a very interesting book about the untold story of America's secret campaign against Al-Qaeda. Counterstrike is the title. But let's just start from the beginning, actually, and talk about terrorism today. What is the biggest threat today? So we can kind of then work our way back a little bit and talk about how things have changed and bring it back to, you know, what we're doing about terrorism today. What is the biggest threat today?
Sure. I think Al-Qaeda Central is something that the U.S. government always has to be aware of. But I think that the offspring and step offspring and cousins, let's call it a spreading cancer, of some of the other organizations are far more active and deadly today. First, of course, is the Islamic State, which is holding territory in both Syria and Iraq. Very unusual terrorist group because they're actually trying to establish a real-life state or a caliphate by holding territory and collecting taxes and all that sort of stuff while also maintaining sort of overseas goals of terrorism. I guess I have to say, though, that on the ground in Syria and Iraq, they're being rolled back. The American and coalition military effort is very effective. Unfortunately, like a cancer that has spread, ISIS is now not just having followers in Europe, but really established cells, as we've seen in Paris and Brussels. And even if ISIS on the ground in the Middle East is somehow really rolled back and circumscribed, I fear the threat to Europe is going to be with us for a while.
Well, I want to get to what we're going to do about that here in a second. But in your book, Counterstrike, you talk about the effective news strategies that have been developed to fight terrorism. And you actually refer to them as being quite successful and in some ways an adaptation of previous strategies during the Cold War period. Can you tell us a little bit about what you mean by that, what those strategies were, how it was we were able to combat Al-Qaeda, how it was we were able to kill Osama bin Laden, and then, you know, kind of how those things have changed so that we can bring it up to what we're going to do today?
Sure. Thank you very much. You know, after 9/11, really the U.S. government chose just a military option. Drop a lot of bombs, fire a lot of weapons. There's a bit of a cliche in the military that if all you have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. And they were just hammering on Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and in Pakistan and elsewhere. But over time, they realized that you can you know, rack and stack terrorist fighters like cordwood, and that's just not going to solve the problem. You really have to get to how these terror groups operate. And so a lot of smart thinkers look back to sort of Cold War deterrence and Cold War containment strategies and realize that terrorists require money to operate. So let's go after the financial networks. That is not a military effort. That is lawyers and Treasury Department officials. Let's identify the enablers who support terrorist activities, the people who rent the safe houses, the people who make the bombs, because a lot of these people are very involved in terrorism, but they themselves do not want to make the ultimate sacrifice and die. And so there are ways to bring pressure on them, especially the financial networks and some of the other enablers, to really constrict their behavior and in that way sort of constrict the terrorist activities.
So in terms of the kinds of multiple strategies that we're having to take, how is it, though, that when you've gone from an organization like Al-Qaeda, which was fairly identifiable, to an organization like ISIS, which, as you mentioned, lots of cells. Now, you noted that they've been rolled back, that there are the attacks by multiple parties in Iraq and Syria to try to combat ISIS on the ground there, but they've proliferated. They are now very diffuse. I mean, that is the one thing that we've learned about terrorists is that they're diffuse organizations and individuals, and you know, intend to include others and incorporate others on a regular and daily basis. So identifying enablers, containing, working on the financials, that seems to work on the kind of the larger structure. But what kind of law enforcement or other types of activities, because it doesn't seem to me military really helps with those types of problems, the diffuse nature of terrorist organizations. What is it that we can do about that? What are we doing about that?
Yeah, it's an absolutely fabulous question. I think that the recent attacks in Paris and Brussels have shown what works and what hasn't worked and what's needed. After 9/11 here in the U.S., there was a learning period because traditionally diplomats don't really like talking to spies. The spies distrust the military. Military's in its own world. But after 9/11, the U.S. government really broke down a lot of the traditional walls that separated law enforcement, intelligence, diplomacy, and the military. Europe, despite the European Union and open borders, those governments still do not share very well. And while we can never say for sure that the Brussels attacks could have been prevented, we are now learning that a lot of puzzle pieces to what was going to happen were held by different institutions in different countries. They just didn't share. So what needs to be done in Europe is they need to share a lot more information to perhaps be able to detect these attacks in advance. But the bigger question, and you, of course, being an academic professor and looking at things broadly, you know, we're never going to really solve the terrorist problem until societies solve the underlying problems, poverty, poverty of education, poverty of jobs, especially poverty of hope. And the Islamic community in Belgium arrived poor and has stayed poor. And before coming to the show, I looked up these statistics just to be sure. Belgium has sent almost 500 of its citizens of Muslim faith to Iraq and Syria, where they've learned and come back. As a percentage, that's the highest in the world. Here in the U.S., sure, there are still problems of race relations and integration and all of that. But, you know, Muslim Americans as a demographic are completely integrated. Their median incomes are the same as everybody else. The asterisk on that is the Somali American community, which hasn't adapted. So it really is, it sounds so old-fashioned and Sunday schoolish, but until we start treating our fellow man better and expanding opportunities, the pool of disenfranchised, angry young men is going to continue.
My guest is Tom Shanker, who spent 14 years as the New York Times Pentagon correspondent before becoming the assistant Washington editor in 2014. Let's take a break, and then we'll talk some more about how to manage or mitigate both domestic and international terrorism. I'm Suzette Gorlat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlat, the dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. I've been talking with Tom Shanker, who's the assistant Washington editor at the New York Times. He's also the co-author of Counterstrike, The Untold Story of America's Secret Campaign Against Al-Qaeda. You can read an excerpt of that book online at kgou.org. When we left off, he argued terrorism would never be deterred without first addressing underlying problems like poverty, unemployment, and a lack of educational opportunities in both the Middle East and the West. Well, I just had here to ask you about this disenfranchisement that I think many have suggested, the fact that young people in particular, and we have a very young population in many of these parts of the world, they're marginalized. They don't have the opportunity. They don't have the education. And we keep seeing this not only growing, but just kind of repeating, this pattern repeating. So addressing things like poverty and education, as you suggest, but I want to go back to what you said about solving the problem. Is this just something, terrorism, that we've been living with for a long time? International terrorism, maybe not so much, but terrorist activity in general is really not all that new. And so solving it, are we really talking about minimizing it, managing it, mitigating the negative consequences of this sort of thing? And that requires tools from all these different angles, not just the military and law enforcement tools, not just the, trying to deal with the supply of terrorists, if you will, but trying to manage, minimize this disenfranchisement and the fact that you're creating demand, I guess. Someone once said recently that it's about belonging. It's almost like gang warfare in inner city, America years ago, when they would talk about belonging. You had to belong to something, and that these young people don't belong to anything. And so they end up belonging to these types of organizations and being encouraged to and participating in these types of activities. Is this how you see it? I mean, is this really what you think we should do? And if so, how are we going to get ourselves to that point, to where we see it more as that kind of problem than as a military or law enforcement one?
Yeah, it's an utterly...
huge question,
it's an utterly fascinating point. I'm so glad you underscored my use of the word solve, because that really was not the best phrase. Your use of the phrase manage the problem, that's it, absolutely. And from our side, and it's the point that we make in the closing chapter of our book, which is as relevant now as when it was published, is the need for Americans to become more resilient. I mean, when did we become such a fearful place? And just as you say, terrorism is not going away. It's going to be with us. I don't want to alarm people, but there is going to be another attack here, because the American law enforcement, intelligence, military has to be good and lucky every day, whereas terrorists only have to get lucky now and then. So it is going to happen. And so the most important thing for Americans to do is to be resilient. And here we are in Norman, just south of Oklahoma City. And when I travel the country or the world talking about terrorism, I say, my hometown of Oklahoma City really set the standard for how you should respond to a terrorist attack. After the horrific bombing of the Murrah Building, what did Oklahoma City do? They buried the dead, they mourned. But here, the capital of one of the reddest states in America, anti-big government, anti-taxes, passed all these city taxes year after year after year to rebuild Oklahoma City into one of the most lovely and delightful middle-sized towns in America. And if there's any way to say to Timothy McVeigh in his grave and to other wannabe terrorists that you didn't win, look at how resilient and beautiful Oklahoma City is. And that's how we, again, manage terrorism, by responding in ways that show terrorists that they haven't terrorized us.
And perhaps even in a collective way, right? I mean, that we don't necessarily overcome these things individually and on our own. I mean, that is a big part of it. But this goes back to your comment earlier about the need to cooperate and share information and see terrorism as the problem that it really isn't. It's a collective one, that many of us, not just the United States, not just Europe, many of us around the world are experiencing these types of attacks. Look what's happened recently in Pakistan and other parts of the Middle East. In fact, I saw something recently that said that overwhelmingly 90% or so of the victims of terrorism are Muslims from other parts of the world. They're not Europeans. They're not Americans. So this is a collective problem that requires collective reaction, collective response, and a collective resilience, right? But the challenge is convincing everyone that it's a collective issue and a collective response, and a collective resilience needs to emerge.
Right. Again, if I was president, I'd make you national security advisor, because you're exactly right. And your point about the majority of victims of militant terrorism being Muslims is absolutely right. But what's important is to relay that message to the Muslim world. And the problem is Americans can't do it. When Americans speak about Islam to the Muslim world, especially Americans of a Judeo-Christian background, it sounds patronizing and insulting. The people who have to carry that message of tolerance and moderation to the Muslim world are Muslims themselves who live there. And at most, what the U.S. can do, to your collective point, is help amplify those voices and spread that word. But if we try and do it ourselves, it will be insulting. It goes back to that horrible phrase from Vietnam about how we tried to win hearts and minds. How terribly insulting and condescending. The goal of U.S. policy should be to earn respect and trust.
Well, I have to end on this note because someone recently asked me as I was giving a talk about turbulence around the world, how sustainable is terrorist activity anyway? How sustainable is something like ISIS? Now, you've already admitted, and I think we all agree, these things are going to happen. We can manage, minimize, mitigate. Solving, probably not. But organizations like ISIS, is this a model for the future? I mean, are we going to be dealing with that type of thing from here on out to that extent, to this degree? Or is this really something that's all that sustainable for them? That can they really do anything other than, for lack of a better way of putting it, just kind of bite our ankles every now and then, off and on?
Right. I think the model we see today is, of course, an evolution from the old Al-Qaeda Central that was just operating in hiding places in Pakistan. Again, ISIS holds territory. Boko Haram in West Africa holds territory. Cells in the Maghreb and Libya are trying to hold territory. So the terrorist model is evolving, and it will continue to evolve. We just need to stay ahead of that. But I think this kind of violence is sustainable. And as you said, you know, whether you call it biting your ankle or whatever, every terrorist death above zero is too many. But we also have to keep in mind that as tragic as those small number of deaths are, efforts need to be done at the strategic level to keep true weapons of mass destruction out of their hands. And at the more tactical level, we have to understand that those sorts of attacks like we've seen in Paris and in Brussels and even in San Bernardino here, however tragic is every loss of life, are not real threats to our existence. And we have to respond calmly and in a measured fashion and not so overreact out of fear that we actually hand terrorists a strategic communications victory.
So let's end on that note. How hopeful are you that we can pull that off and not overreact in the future?
Well, it's interesting. I think I'm more optimistic that combined efforts will keep terrorist attacks to a sustainable, if tragic, level. I am not completely optimistic about the resilience question, because to talk about resilience is an admission by a political leader that there will be another attack. And as much as important as that conversation is, no politician can use the R word, resilience, because it makes them sound as if they're giving up.
Well, Tom Shanker, thank you so much for being here on Worldviews and sharing your insight. Thank you
very much.
It was
a great honor. Thank you for asking me in.
I've been listening to my conversation with Tom Shanker. He's a former Pentagon correspondent for the New York Times and the co-author of the book Counterstrike, The Untold Story of America's Secret Campaign Against Al-Qaeda. There's a link to the book online at kgou.org. KGOU produces Worldviews with the support of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Sam Dupre produces the show with the oversight of our digital editor, Brian Hardzinski, and Miranda Wilson prepares our research. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Rolott.